Accession number 4784, Reel 8.
Reverend Sernbash, Reel 7, could you tell me a little bit more about the kind of activities that people filled their time with at Stanley when they weren't working?
We had people in the camp who were proficient in quite a number of languages. Chinese, of course, being the popular language. There were so many who were employed either in government or business in Hong Kong who would find it an advantage to be proficient in both writing and speaking Chinese. And we had those among us who were able to do really first-class teaching. One man particularly, an elderly missionary, Wells his name was, who wrote years before one of the established grammars and primers in the Chinese language. He was absolutely a wizard with it. And he set up a whole lot of classes with himself in general charge and a number of others who were proficient Chinese scholars in charge. And lots of people really came to have a good command of Chinese through the years that they spent in the camp and through attending the classes. We had people from Malaya who taught Malayan. There were other languages spoken in other parts of the Far East. Quite a number. We had the people with us who knew Japanese, and people thought it was worth their while to learn Japanese. How wise they were, because we never knew at that time that Japan would become the sort of power that she is in the commercial and industrial world today. So these were going on. And
how did the Japanese feel about the internees learning their language?
I don't know if they knew. I don't know if they knew. They may have done, and I think they would have been proud, because it would have been an indication to them that they thought that the Japanese language was something worth learning. And then, as I have said, especially with having the books that came in with the American Club, there were those among us who were competent and knowledgeable enough to give courses of lectures in all sorts of things, in science, in botany, in engineering, mathematics, all that sort. There were classes in these things going on increasingly all the time as time went on. Believe it or not, we had one or two expert cooks in the camp who gave lessons in cookery in the hope that a time would come when somebody would be able to make use of the get-togethers of a few friends to amuse one another, to play bridge, to talk together. These were the activities that went on and occupied people's times.
Did you run a camp newspaper?
No. No.
That wasn't possible. No.
The only record that I knew that was actually made was the one made by the man who was acting as the secretary of the camp committee. And I know that he kept these manuscripts. In moments of danger, he used to bury them in the cemetery. Then when it had passed, it dug them up again. He put the whole lot together in a manuscript form. He and I were great friends, and I happened to leave the camp and come home before he did. He was a member of the British American Tobacco Company, and he was fit enough at the end of the war. He was one PC man anyhow, and he'd lots of stuff and was able to buy lots of black market stuff and kept himself fit. And so he was able to stay in Hong Kong long enough to help his company to get going again after the war. And he asked me to bring this manuscript home, which he'd written about the camp, on the basis of the minutes of the camp committee, and I did. But at that time, you see, we were the last people to be relieved to get home, and when I came home, I found the publishers were overladen with books about the war, camps and what have you.
Yes,
and
yes.
They would only touch this if we could finance it in case it didn't pay. We weren't able to do that.
Can I take you back to Stanley, please? You mentioned the concerts. Now, they sound as if they were quite an important feature.
They were an important feature, very important indeed. And we discovered wonderful talent in the camp. I mean, people wrote songs, they wrote plays, they put together various acts which made up a whole concert. And in a place where hardly anybody had anything to wear, in some ways they managed to dress some of these shows. And those who were experienced in these matters used to say that they were some of the best amateur productions they had ever seen anywhere.
What were the sort of performances that stick out in your mind?
I suppose what we would call the miscellaneous concerts, with various people doing their own particular thing, and the whole thing being put together as a sort of variety show. Most of our concerts were of that nature. We had with us a lady who had been a very prominent ballet teacher, and she taught the children and some of the young ladies, and they did quite a lot of dancing, as long as they were able to do it. And others who'd had quite a lot of experience in the theatrical world, they came into their own in these productions. And they kept these things going, and they were very popular. They attracted, as you would expect, great crowds all the way through.
Did romance ever blossom in these rather unpromising?
Oh, yes, we had 22 marriages in the camp. 22. And these had to be sort of, ratified, or whatever word you would use, by a special act of Parliament to legalise them after the war. But they were actually married in the camp by the clergy of the camp. They were married in St. Stephen's Great Hall, which was our church, and they both married in the camp and produced children in the camp.
Were the single women in any way segregated?
No. As I've pointed out, the shocking thing in some ways about the camp was that when it was first put together, the Japanese guards just shoved everybody, irrespective of relationship, sex or anything else, into the rooms as they came to them. And they remained that way. But, you know, people settled down with each other, living in those jammed conditions, and we had very little trouble in the way of personal relationship troubles of that nature. People settled down with each other somehow. I mean, modesty and all that sort of thing, that went by the board immediately. And yet not in a nasty way. You see, we went round practically naked. Nobody thought anything about it. And it was so in the rooms. I mean, people dressing and undressing. I mean, a dozen people in a room. Mm. A room like this would have had half a dozen people in.
Was escape a subject of interest amongst internees?
In the early days, one or two escapes were possible. As soon as the Japanese really got control of the camp and put barbed wire all round it, remembering that we were surrounded almost entirely by the sea, and the only connection with the mainland, with the island of Hong Kong, was this narrow causeway with Stanley Peninsula onto the rest of the island. This became so easy to guard that it was literally impossible. After the first escapes, and when the Japanese were aware of this, no escapes took place after the first ones. Mm. It was also, the Japanese made this very clear, that if anything like that happened, the rest of the camp would be punished. They believed in corporate punishment, not just individual punishment. That's why I took more than one hammering for something I'd never done, because I happened to be chairman of that particular camp. And if anything pretty bad in their eyes happened, they put the screws on everybody in that area, in some way or other, so that people were reminded, if you do try to escape, remember what will happen to the rest of your folk who are still here. And I think I can say that I knew of one or two cases who had planned to escape but who didn't, because of the consequences they felt would come upon those left behind.
How were those early escapes you referred to, how were they achieved?
They made arrangements with the Sampan population. In those days, you see, they could get out of the camp before it was thoroughly ringed round with barbed wire and guarded and lighted on occasion. They just got out onto the shore and made arrangement with the Sampan people, who were always ready to pick them up and take them into Free China. And that's how the early escapes were made, and that's how the first real news of the camp got out and got ultimately to England, with the information that some of these people took out and got up to Chongqing.
Now, at what stage did liberation become a real prospect?
There were those in the camp, you know, who were always hoping, well, the next 3 months will see us through. After we had been there, say, 3.5 years, and with everybody going steadily downhill, we began to wonder, we really did begin to wonder, whether the camp would end before we did. It did, of course, but in a way beyond anybody's expectation. After 3.5 years, as far as we could see, if the war could only end by an ultimate attack on the mainland of Japan itself, it was going to be some time. And I doubt very much whether we could have lasted out that time. So that all had its effect upon how people thought about the end of the war. And then through our radio, we discovered that something appalling had happened in Japan. It was the dropping of the atomic bomb, of course, but that wasn't in our purview at all. We'd no idea what it was that had happened, but we did know that something new, in the way of an appalling instrument of destruction, had been used, and that the likelihood was that this would bring Japan to her knees. And that, of course, is what actually happened, and that was our salvation. Now, as I say, our radio people got this, and they also got the news of the actual Japanese surrender. The day before, the camp authorities broke the news to us, and they were going about the camp acting in such a way that we knew something had happened. And then the colonial secretary was sent for by Japanese headquarters, and the Japanese camp commandant at that time, a man named Lieutenant Hara, who hadn't been too bad with us at all, he told Mr. Jimson that the Emperor had been pleased to grant peace to the world and to bring the hostilities to an end by the Potsdam terms, and that hostilities, therefore, had come to an end. The camp would carry on as it had been doing until arrangements could be made. And that was our first announcement.
What was the reaction in camp?
The first reaction will surprise you, I think. We often tried to visualise what would happen at the end, in what way it was likely to come, and we tried to make arrangements as to what we would do in case it was A, B, C or D, the way of release. Well, here it came, sort of overnight. I mean, today, our chances of survival seemed hopeless. Today we lived. And the thing came so suddenly that somehow people went about almost in a state of daze and stupor. We thought that when the news of the Japanese surrender actually broke, we should go mad. Well, we didn't. I couldn't help remembering the words of one of the Psalms. When the Lord turned again to the captivity of Zion, we were like them that dream, sort of couldn't take it in. And it took us a day to realize it's over, we're free, the relieving forces will come. So the first thing we did, of course, was to arrange a great service of thanksgiving. It was my great honour, one I'll never forget, to conduct that service. And of course, the total camp were there. Those who couldn't get in, they stood around watching through the windows at St. Stephen's Great Hall. And that's how we sort of adjusted to our new status. Meanwhile, the Japanese left us entirely alone. They disappeared. Well, then planes came over and they dropped supplies into the camp by parachute. Great excitement to see these multicoloured parachutes coming down and dropping stuff into the camp. They also dropped orders telling us what to do and what not to do, telling us, among other things, that because of the suddenness of the Japanese surrender, it wouldn't be possible to arrange for a relieving force to come to us, probably for a fortnight. Meanwhile, stay in your camps. Don't run any risk. We won't be responsible for anything that happens to anybody who tries to break this rule. The Japanese are under orders from us to see to it that you are kept in safety and you're looked after. So stay put until we come. Now, when we received this news, the camp committee went into immediate session. For this reason, through our radios, we had reason to believe that when the end of the war did come, there were American influences which were determined that Hong Kong should not go back to Britain, but be put under Chinese jurisdiction. So some of us said in the camp, I was one of them, look, if we sit here waiting for the relieving forces to come, Hong Kong is lost. She'll be passed over to Chinese jurisdiction. The only thing that we can do to save this situation, if it can be done at all, is to go out now, take notice of the orders that have been given to us. After all, they've come to us from American sources, not from our own. It was General Biedermeier who issued them. And I said, we'll go out and re-establish the Hong Kong government before anybody comes into us at all. So we said, how can we do it? I said, well, we've got the Hong Kong police, and they'll be able to maintain law and order. We've got enough experienced government servants to go out and restart government. The only doubtful quantity is the Japanese, because they're the only people who are still armed, and we can't disarm them. Only the relieving forces will be able to do that when they come. Mm. But we had noticed that the surrender had knocked all the heart out of them, knocked them for six, and they were only too willing now to cooperate with us. Yesterday they were giving the orders and knocking us about. Today they were taking every order from us and obviously glad to do it. So we were quite sure that we should have no trouble with them. So on one particular morning, an official group of us, headed by the colonial secretary, the senior government servants, myself as chairman of the camp and deputy to the colonial secretary himself, we went out. And we took over a group of buildings owned by the French mission and re-established the Hong Kong government there. The Hong Kong police were deployed through the colony together with the Japanese who cooperated with them, and they maintained law and order. And we got the wheels of government going again. And by the time, a fortnight later, when Admiral Harcourt and the relief train came into the camp, he was absolutely astonished when he came ashore to find that this was happening. As a matter of fact, we had got the Hong Kong press going again to the extent that we published the first broadsheet of the new regime that very day, and it was headed fleet arriving today, Admiral Harcourt. We'd got this information. And so many ships, naming them and that sort of thing, will arrive in the harbour this afternoon and are expected to go out to Stanley and raise the flag this afternoon. Mm. And that's what newsboys were handing over to his men as they came ashore. I'm sure, and many of us are sure, that is why Hong Kong remained British That is why it is British today. Because when the relieving forces came and found that this was done, that we were actually in office, only an international incident of major importance would have done anything to destroy what we had done. Nobody was in any mood at that time to do that sort of thing. And I'm sure that that's the truth of why Hong Kong is British today. And as far as I know, I'm the last remaining member of that group who went out. All the rest have gone.
What sort of condition did you find Hong Kong in?
An appalling mess. Very different to what we expected. I mean, the Japanese in their own country are a clean people. Evidently, there had come a time in Hong Kong when they realized that they were not going to win, that there was only going to be one end to this, and they gave up. And in those months, I mean, rubbish and filth had accumulated everywhere, and we took over a colony in a dreadful state. And it was quite a surprise to us.
Mm. Now, you were given special responsibility for winding up the affairs of the camp. Tell
yes.
me about that episode.
Yes, well now, and we'll probably make this the conclusion. After Admiral Harcourt and his men came into the camp and took over, then he became the military governor. The colonial secretary became his sort of equal, I suppose. But the first thing that he did was to send him home to report to the home government. Meanwhile, he asked me, as the deputy of the colonial secretary, if I would stay on and see to the disbanding of the camp, because he says, obviously, you know more about than anybody else. Well, my wife was in such a sick condition that she had to go on hospital ship to go home. I couldn't go with her because able-bodied people were not allowed on the hospital ship. Her own people at the home end were all ready to receive her. And so I said, all right, I will. I'll stay on. And I'll do this job. Everybody, of course, was anxious to get out, and they had all sorts of requests to make as to what part of the world they wanted to go to. It was really a very tricky problem, because we were not to know who would accept them and who wouldn't. We had to take chances on some of them. And, of course, we had to do it bit by bit, because it could only be done as ships came into Hong Kong with sufficient space to take a few here, a few there. And so I started this business of disbanding the camp. There was an old sea captain named Taylor, Skip Taylor. He said to me, I've nobody to go home to, particularly Ernest. I'll lay here and look after you while you get on with this job of dispersing the camp. And that's what happened. And so as ship's space became available, I sent parties here, there and everywhere. Until eventually the day came when there was nobody left.
What sort of criteria did you apply in arranging the order by which people were returned, were repatriated?
It depended upon what places in the world they wanted to go to and when there were ships going to those places. Then when there was a ship going to those places, this group of people who wanted to go there were put on board that ship. Mm. Quite a number, of course, went back into Hong Kong to their relatives and people there. Quite a number who had nowhere to go to. Provision was made for them at Bridge of Weir in Scotland, and a sort of quite a biggish camp was established there to take our folk from Hong Kong until they could be sort of rehabilitated. Quite a number went to India. And that was my job, to fit where people went to the ships that were going there until eventually we'd work through everybody. And we came to the morning when Skip Taylor and myself were the only people there. So first thing we did, we went through all the rooms, you know, to see that there was nothing left, nobody left. The surprising thing was that we found that people in their excitement had left behind quite a lot of stuff. And we gathered all this together. Meanwhile, the Hong Kong prison had reopened and was under our control again. And I asked the superintendent to put aside a room. And we put all the stuff that we found in various parts of the camp, which we felt sure people would lay some claim to later on, into this particular room and lock it up and store it there until the request came from the people to whom it belonged. So Skip and I went through the rooms. They'd been so busy, so crowded, so bustling, and it was like a morgue. Yeah, it gave me a creepy feeling to go through it. So we went to the gate, and I shut it. And I took one last look of the whole campus. I said a prayer. I said, please God, this will never happen again. And then I turned and I said to Skip, come on, Skip, let's go. And we climbed into the jeep which Admiral Harcourt had put at my disposal. And we drove away to freedom. And that was the end.
I imagine with the many people you had to repatriate, the biggest group would be Britons to be returned to Britain.
Yes.
And in that case, you had a responsibility to fix the order of priority by which they should be placed on the ships that became available. And I wonder what kind of criteria you used.
I can only say that didn't seem to present any problem. As people were ready to go, then when ship space became available, we got them away, and there was no pushing or shoving or criticism or anything like that. We did this in a fairly short space of time, so that there was not much problem like that. And it seemed to sort of sort itself out. Many people, of course, wanted to go with each other who were either relatives or neighbours or anything like that.
Did you find for yourself or for people of your acquaintance who were also interned in Stanley that after 3.5 years of the closed life of internment, that the actual openness of freedom had certain problems and difficulties?
It certainly had. You know, they had to just give themselves time to sort of rather take all this in, to adjust to it. And the voyage home was the time that many of them used to do that sort of thing.
What sort of feelings, interment, were common? How did you feel yourself?
Happy, of course. Anxious, first of all, to get home to England and to be reunited with family. As I say, my wife had gone ahead of me in the hospital ship, and so she was home before I was. Our three children were in America, where they had been sent, and where they had been looked after by relatives of ours. And one of the first jobs I had to do when I did get back home was to make arrangements for them to come back to England, and so that they could be reunited with us there. But being the last man out of the camp, Skip Taylor and I managed to get passages aboard a ship that was coming to England. But the others who were on that ship were mainly people from Shanghai. And together we came home. At Suez, a sort of depot had been set up there to provide clothing, and particularly clothing, for these groups who were going home, and we picked up a bit of clothing there, although so many had been before us that there was practically nothing left when Skip Taylor and I got to it, and I got home to England with next to nothing. But the thing was to get home to England, and I got home. My wife was staying with her people who were in Huddersfield in Yorkshire, and I remember the day when I landed at Huddersfield Station, and there they were waiting for me. And after that, in due time, I came down to Southampton and picked up the three children. Only one of them knew me. That was the eldest boy, who's back in America today. The other two, they'd forgotten all about me. We'd been away from them so often, and that's how it all ended up.
Mm.